This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, August 27th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, political ads are becoming more prevalent as we inch closer to Election Day. Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics leads a roundtable discussion to analyze the ads. Plus, Northwest Arkansas has been selected as the pilot community for the Cisneros Center's American Dream Initiative, and we'll learn more about the program. Also, a newly published monograph explores racial cleansing in the state. A new Benton County Medical Center is offering free flu shots and more. But first, state legislators continue to look for a solution to the long beleaguered health insurance program for public school employees. A task force led by Republican Senate Majority Leader Jim Hendren heard remarks Tuesday from an array of education and benefits officials in a preliminary discussion about merging the school employee plan with a state employee plan. Hendren says after the meeting he doesn't expect the legislature to pursue merging the two.
Well, we heard testimony that demonstrated that there are programs designed for different populations. There would be no significant cost savings, so instead what you would have is a program that is doing a poor job of serving more people.
Although the school employees insurance program may be merged with the program for other state employees, Hendren says control of public schools insurance plans may be shifted back to the individual school districts, which he says may be better to solve the problem of skyrocketing costs.
Should the state get out of the insurance business and let the school districts handle it? Send the dollars to the school districts and say, go get your insurance bought on the private market or co-op with other school districts. So we're going to investigate basically farming it back out to the school district approach. We'll still send them the dollars, but then they're on their own to go get their insurance.
The legislature has called a special session twice this year to make changes to the public school employee health insurance program to curtail some premium hikes. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith has received a sizable grant to help bolster workforce training efforts in the area. The $734,000 award to the college's Center for Business and Professional Development is part of a $2.5 million job-driven national emergency grant given to the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services by the U.S. Department of Labor. Dave Robertson is the director of the Center for Business and Professional Development, and he says the money will be used for instructor salaries and course-related materials for a training program that aims to enroll up to 400 veterans and long-term unemployed local residents in training programs for employment sectors specific to the Fort Smith area.
We identified three areas where we knew there would be demand for skilled workers, and so what we decided to do was work to provide commercial driver's license, CDL training for CDL drivers, and then medical billing and coding is an area of education where people can find jobs within the healthcare industry. It's a great entry-level position in the healthcare industry, whether you work for a hospital, a physician's clinic, or maybe even an insurance company. And then in the industry and manufacturing area, there's always a lot of demand for what we call multi-craft technicians. So these are basically entry-level maintenance positions, people that are comfortable with electricity, hydraulics, basic machining, welding, programmable logic controls or PLCs, that sort of thing.
Robertson says the workforce training program will be administered with assistance from three other partner agencies, the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services, Winrock International, and the Western Arkansas Employment Development Agency, or WAEDA.
WAEDA will help us source the dislocated workers, make sure that they qualify, make sure that they've been unemployed for a while, or they're facing a layoff, that they fit the definition of a dislocated worker. And then Winrock International will help us with supportive services and case managers for these people. So they'll have a case manager assigned to a particular student. We'll help them get enrolled in the coursework, help them if they need help with things like child care or mileage or temporary housing, that sort of thing, so that they can concentrate on the education piece. And then there's a large part of the grant will go towards on-the-job training. Once the people have completed the educational portion, we intend to work with local employers to get them temporary jobs where they can get on-the-job training.
Robertson says the on-the-job training gained through those temporary jobs could give workers practical experience that could give them a leg up over other applicants for permanent employment positions. The long-term employment picture in the Arkansas River Valley continues to improve. New unemployment data released today by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows the area's unemployment rate was 6.5% in July, which is slightly higher than June numbers, but nearly 2 full percentage points lower than 1 year ago. The overall labor force did shrink by more than 5,000 workers year over year. In Northwest Arkansas, the unemployment rate also sank compared to last year. Last month, the unemployment rate was 5.3%, 1 full point lower than a year ago, but 0.4 of a point higher than in June. Year to year, the overall Northwest Arkansas labor force also shrank by about 3,600 people. The city of Fayetteville has pushed off the groundbreaking for its downtown parking deck. Jeremy Pate, the city's director of development services, says when bids were opened and calculated Friday, the project came in well over budget.
Particularly of concern was our concrete package, which was estimated at around $2.7 million, and it came in around $4.5 million. So just one package alone out of those 42 was $1.8 million over budget. We were expecting to be over budget on the project from the original estimates back in 2012, and we had let the council in on that. We were not expecting being over budget anywhere this magnitude. So after having a conversation with the mayor about what we had opened on Monday morning, he made the decision to go ahead and call off the groundbreaking, primarily because we simply didn't want to start a project where we felt like we didn't have a reasonable level of confidence in the costs associated with the project and the revenue that we had to pay for it.
Pate says while there's no clear reason as to why the concrete bids for the deck came in nearly $2 million over estimate, a number of factors could have contributed to the large price tag, including underestimated costs for concrete materials, an uptick in construction activity, which means that contractors have less capacity to take on more construction projects, and the scarcity of companies who bid on the parking deck's concrete package. Because the project bids came in well over budget, Pate says it will be reevaluated and rebid, but depending on the process taken, the time frame for the reevaluation could vary.
So there's, you know, in the continuum of sort of not doing the project all the way to using the current bids, there's about 5 or 6 at least options that we've identified, and there may be more combinations thereof. You know, there's everything from rebidding the entire project to just simply rebidding portions of it, to allowing the contractor, the construction manager that we have under contract right now, Baldwin Shell, allowing them to provide us with some pricing to self-perform the work. That basically means that they would take on the responsibility as opposed to subcontracting it out. And I think they're working on several of those options right now. We hope to, within a month, make the decision of how to proceed with the project.
But in terms of the overall schedule for the parking deck construction, Pate says the delay of a month or two will still allow the parking deck to be complete by sometime in late 2015. LaFleur County, Oklahoma voters yesterday approved a sales tax issue that will help fund structural and other infrastructure repairs and renovations at the Eastern Oklahoma Medical Center in Poto. Nearly 77% of the vote, or 5,246 votes, went in favor of the half-cent sales tax increase, while 1,584 voted against. The John Brown University volleyball team is now 5-1 after sweeping 2 matches yesterday in Texas. JBU defeated Jarvis Christian and Wiles University in straight 3-0 fashion. Next up for JBU is the Baker University Invitational in Kansas this weekend. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals continue their final road trip of the season tonight in Tulsa. Last night, the Nats were dropped by the Drillers 6-5. Tonight's weather forecast calls for partly cloudy skies with lows in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, expect sunny conditions with highs around 93. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of overnight showers and thunderstorms and lows from 68 in Northwest Arkansas to 72 in the Arkansas River Valley. You've no doubt seen just a few political ads on TV. Maybe you've heard them on the radio in the last few months. Well, this week, some new TV ads made their debut in the Senate and governor's races. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics recently hosted a roundtable discussion on the ads. Roby spoke with John Brummett, political columnist with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, Talk Business and Politics contributor Steve Bronner, who's also the owner and operator of the Independent Arkansas blog, and KATV's lead Capitol reporter Janelle Lilly.
The new Pryor ad, it's the first time we get a chance to see his dad make a debut in this ad. And I first of all want to kick it off to you, John. Mm-hmm. What did you think about the ad? What did you think about bringing David Pryor into it? And do you think it's effective?
I think it's potentially the best ad of the year, the most effective. I think it addresses every one of Mark Pryor's needs. It brings his dad out to remind people, particularly seniors who have been leaning Republican. By the way, this is my daddy. You used to love him. Two, let's talk about Obamacare without the Obamacare brand. Let's do that. And three, let me tell you my soft, moving, personal narrative. So I think he seeks for it to be kind of a magic elixir for everything that he needs, and it may in fact be that.
And you alluded to the fact that it did not name the name Obamacare in it. Do you think that's something that folks are going to pick up on? Do you feel like it's something that will inhibit the effectiveness of this ad?
I am not surprised that Senator Pryor has brought in his father or that he has defended Obamacare, because he's been doing that. I was surprised that he didn't use the words Affordable Care Act. Not Obamacare. I certainly shouldn't use that. But by not really specifying what law he's talking about, that leaves people ready to ask questions. And I think it would have been interesting if he would have just gone ahead and said, I voted for the Affordable Care Act, which did this. It certainly would have helped us have a more honest debate about that instead of this constant kind of bickering about semantics. I wish he would have kind of just gone and said, I voted for the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I know in polling when we've looked at that issue a number of times, it's just all about messaging. It depends on how you phrase it, what words you use.
I don't think the Affordable Care Act is a big winner in Arkansas either. And a lot of people talk all the time about a law I voted for, a bill I voted for. It's obviously tactical. And there's a way to respond to it. The Koch brothers or Cotton or somebody is apt to find a cancer victim who had his or her policy canceled and had her rates increased, and can talk about, I'm glad your life was saved, and I'm glad you're able to get your bills paid for, but I'm sorry you cast the deciding vote for Obamacare and it cost me more money. I look for that. The Koch brothers or somebody will find that, and we'll flesh all this out in due course.
Let's look at another ad that we've got too. Is the Tom Cotton ad that came out this week too, called Hypocrisy. A little bit of a mixture as to how much of it was on TV, but this is basically where there's a 2011 interview where Mark Pryor suggests that raising the retirement age to 68 or 69 for Social Security could help shore up the fiscal solvency of that program. Steve, is the 68 or 69, is that his firm position, or did he just suggest it as an option?
If I was writing an article for PolitiFact, I would rate this mostly true, in that it is fair to say that the senator is being inconsistent, because at the time, not only in that interview, but in other interviews and speeches, he was definitely talking up the fact that something has to be done about Social Security and Medicare. And in that interview, he does not technically say, I support raising retirement age. What he uses as an example for teenagers, people his kids' age, raising the retirement age. But he was saying this is a viable option. Mm-hmm. And now much of his campaign is being based on that Tom Cotton is Darth Vader for wanting to mess with Social Security and Medicare. So I would rate this mostly true. I'm curious what John thinks about that.
Are you really curious?
I am curious.
I think you know. I would rate it entirely false. A politician in an abstract discussion about things you could do, suggesting something, that is entirely different from voting for it. So I think that to allege hypocrisy between some old statement in which he's thinking out loud about these are things we could do for people now 20 years old is entirely different, and it does not put you at fault for saying your opponent actually, honest to goodness, favors it. So I would rate it totally
Bad. Totally wrong.
All right, on to my favorite ad of this campaign so far, thus far. I'm sure we have a lot more to drop before I can actually give that opinion. But Asa's new ad with his cutie granddaughter, Ella Beth.
Well, that's not editorial.
I'm sorry. This ad speaks to me, you know, and I guess I'm the demographic that I get so tired of seeing the, you know, the political ads, the politicians. This girl is refreshing to me, and she's cute as can be. What is your take on this ad? It's clearly targeted at women probably in my age range.
I think it actually works too on a couple of different levels, in that he gets to talk about a policy position that is a little bit hard to explain at times. Computer coding, I think he does that in a very simple way. He refers to himself as Asa right out of the shoot. First time he's used just his first name to describe himself. And of course, I think at the end when she says Pawpaw, I mean, You've just built the grandfather.
It's the kid, yeah.
He's lost three statewide races. There's this general uncertain idea that people didn't like him much. This is saying, hey, you like me now. I'm Pawpaw, I'm softer, I'm mellower, I'm a good guy. And that's what he needs to do, because all the Republican moot tide is in his favor. Oh, I think he's pretty well ahead in the race right now, and I think this ad is real effective. Real effective, particularly with the gender gap. He was ahead in your poll among women. Yeah.
Not only is it a heartstring puller, but I've watched this, and one of the first times I watched it, I looked down and I thought, he has gotten in so much information in 20 seconds. There's still 10 seconds left in this ad, and he has explained his position on offering computer coding classes to high school students. It is a fantastic ad, one of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah,
as far as just looking at it analytically, the content of the ad, I'm gonna have to say I agree with you. And I don't normally take opinions on this, but just the effectiveness of that child being the storyteller in that ad.
I didn't get much pushback from Democrats either. I think they
sometimes
all...
Sometimes you just say good shot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, well, that is balanced with another ad that is extremely tough on Asa Hutchinson. The new ad came out from the Democratic Governors Association called Wasn't Enough, and it talks about this homestead tax credit that Asa has been found to take two of on two different properties. He has straightened that out, at least financially, but politically, John Brummett, has he straightened this out? Is this ad potentially going to counter some of the goodwill of the other ads?
I don't think so. I don't think people are tuned into this homestead tax issue very much, and I think it's overstated. Tax cheat, not the way we do things in Arkansas. They're trying to. He made a mistake that he shouldn't have made. He went in and corrected it. You make a little point about how you ought to be responsible, but I think the rhetoric is overstated. I think, and it loses its effectiveness. I think.
Well, we all open when the Democrat Gazette or some of the newspaper comes out and it's this thick with the property tax problems, and we all open that thinking, man, I hope I'm not in there, because it's really, you know, an arcane tax law that he did violate, I don't think is enough to move the needle or outrage. This is not the kind of issue that's going to outrage Arkansans. We all struggle to get these taxes right. Saying that he didn't tell the truth, that's awfully, I mean, he was incorrect.
His name was on the line. I mean, he signed a document asking
apparently
for it.
Apparently these things, when you do your mortgages or sign your documents, now this is part of the things. But I don't give him that much of a pass. I mean, I know some people with second houses who manage not to take two credits, and I think the man running for governor shouldn't. I just think the tone of this is, when he's corrected it, I just don't think it's an effective ad.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics, speaking with John Brummett, political columnist with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Talk Business and Politics contributor Steve Bronner, who's also the owner and operator of the Independent Arkansas blog, and KATV's lead Capitol reporter Janelle Lilly. This conversation originally aired on Talk Business and Politics, which can be seen Sunday mornings at 9 on KATV Channel 7 in the Central Arkansas market. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas, Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
On The Next Humankind.
I absolutely believe that as a nation, we could move much more aggressively to renewable energy. And I do believe it could supply a lot more of the load a lot quicker if we did that.
The prospects for scaling up our use of low-carbon renewable energy like wind and solar. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
Sunday mornings at 6 on 91.3 FM.
The Cisneros Center has selected Northwest Arkansas as the community that will participate in the pilot year of the American Dream Initiative. The program focuses on immigrant integration.
And what that really means is we're going to be building relationships in the community, both with local organizations and also with the immigrant community and the receiving community here.
That story is coming up in about 16 minutes here on Ozarks at Large.
One, two, three. Cut the ribbon.
Yesterday afternoon, MedExpress Urgent Care staff celebrated the opening of a new Bentonville location with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. This new medical clinic is the third Northwest Arkansas location for the physician-led, privately-owned company. Nationally, MedExpress operates 135 centers across 11 states. MedExpress was founded in 2001, and last year the company served more than 2 million patients. Officials at yesterday's ceremony expressed the desire to be part of the Bentonville community. The first step they took was presenting a $15,000 check to the Boys and Girls Club of Benton County. Jacob Hudson, Chief Professional Officer for the Boys and Girls Club, says the mission of the organization is to enable and inspire youth to realize their full potential through a safe and nurturing environment. He says part of the way they do that is through healthy lifestyle programming.
We serve nearly 4,000 kids in one of our Benton County facilities every year. We have 1,200 kids that participate in our athletic programs. And so we're excited about this partnership and what this program is going to go towards is supporting healthy lifestyles right here in Benton County for our kids, the Boys and Girls Club. So thank you very much on behalf of us, our staff, our board of directors, and more importantly, our kids that we serve every single day. Thank you.
Paul Lagu, area manager of business operations for MedExpress, says the company will also give back to the community by offering free flu shots.
And I know that people's thinking, wow, it's 110 degrees outside with a heat index, but Christmas is 120 days away. So winter and the flu bug's right around the corner, so we want to help keep the community very healthy.
While it may seem a little early to receive a flu shot, Troy Steckler, Vice President for Medical Operations at MedExpress, says the Centers for Disease Control recommend becoming vaccinated as soon as the vaccine is available in your community.
We've had years where it's had an early start. Our H1N1, the big H1N1 year started in the summer. So, to prevent that from happening, they'd rather people get vaccinated sooner rather than later.
According to the CDC's website, flu vaccine is produced by private manufacturers, so supply depends on them. For the 2014-2015 season, manufacturers have projected they will provide 154 to 160 million doses of vaccine for the U.S. market. Steckler says the vaccine hasn't changed much in recent years.
The predominance of flu by far has been H1N1 and H3N2. And so the flu vaccine hasn't been altered that much year over year the last 4 or 5 years. The World Health Organization, along with the CDC, come up with the most frequent cultured influenza the previous year, and that's what they based their flu vaccine manufacturing off of. And because the last 4 or 5 years, it's been predominantly those two by far, and the formulation of the flu vaccine hasn't changed much. So getting it early on, you're not going to lose its efficacy by the time you need it.
While the CDC recommends everyone 6 months and older should receive a flu vaccine, the organization says it's especially important for pregnant women, people younger than 5 or 65 years old and older, as well as those with certain medical conditions like asthma, diabetes, and chronic lung disease. MedExpress's Bentonville office, which is located at 1005 Southeast Walton Boulevard, officially opens today. The clinic is offering free flu shots to patients 4 years old and older while supplies last. The clinic's hours of operation are 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 7 days a week. MedExpress accepts most insurances, but insurance isn't required for treatment. More information is available at MedExpress.com. Support for KUAF comes from Greenhouse Grill, featuring a seasonal menu of organic, locally grown produce and all-natural meats, plus organic beer and wines. Live weekly music and full-service catering are available. Located at 481 South School in Fayetteville's Mill District and on the web at greenhousegrill.com. It is Wednesday, August 27th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
We really need to hang out.
Okay.
We always see each other here. And we can't see any of you at all, but we'll tell you what's going on anyway. A University of Arkansas at Fort Smith professor is displaying his life's work in art. At the Blue Lion at UAFS downtown.
What kind of art?
His name is Charles Steiner, and he teaches two-dimensional design and a senior capstone course at the university. But he's showing 13 large-scale paintings from different points in his life, from undergrad to now.
Oh, very cool.
That's really interesting. He says, great quote, "I sort of proceeded through different stages of my life, with the exception of the period that was dedicated to glitter." He's 63 now, and he describes himself as a colorist and expressionist, and says all of his works feature exposed brush strokes, and the subject matter ranges from landscapes to self-portrait to aesthetic plate painting, and I have no idea what that means.
It sounds interesting, though.
Yes, it does. His work will be on display through October 27th, so you've got lots of time, at the Blue Lion, which is at 101 North 2nd Street. It was 2nd Street Live at one point in its life. And there's a free reception open to the public from 5:30 to 6:30 Thursday.
Okay. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
We are taking a look at Labor Day, the day when we honor those who have worked so hard to make this the great country that it is. The farmers, the nurses, the carpenters, the miners, the housewives, the soldiers, everybody who did the work to support all of us.
Labor Day celebrated during this week's Folk Sampler. That's Saturday night beginning at 9 on KUAF 91.3.
This is Ozarks at Large. Racial Cleansing in Arkansas, 1883 to 1924, is a newly published monograph by Guy Lancaster, editor of the Encyclopedia of Arkansas History and Culture, which is a project of the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies at the Central Arkansas Library System. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the author examines several dozen incidents of race violence which took place in Arkansas through the lens of politics, land, labor, and criminality.
After the Civil War ended and enslaved African Americans were free to build independent lives, many set their sights on Arkansas, says Dr. Guy Lancaster, who's devoting a portion of his career to researching and writing about historic race relations in Arkansas.
Arkansas had a much more moderate regime of race relations going on at this time. Also in part because Arkansas hadn't really been developed before the Civil War. You know, very few miles of railroads, very few mines, little in the way of a timber industry. And so all these things sort of exploded into being after the Civil War, and there was a tremendous need of labor.
Arkansas African Americans had a chance to start over, Lancaster says, away from southeastern plantations.
People paying hard cash, you know, and that was a real kind of exciting opportunity for African Americans to go and to work in these industries and have financial independence for the first time.
The Southern Homestead Act also provided free land to both blacks and whites, but for many blacks working the land, wage contracts were overtaken by sharecropping contracts, which often accumulated debt. Still, African-American neighborhood and districts were established in many places across Arkansas, and certain whites were not happy. Lancaster points to the first documented race conflict taking place in Van Buren County, where black homesteader Burl Lindsay and others had settled on a place today still referred to as Negro Hill.
He was subject to a campaign of harassment, locals night riding, posting notices, and then attacking him and neighbors during the night, driving them away off their land.
Antagonism towards black independence, Lancaster says, soon resulted in widespread white-on-black violence documented in more than two dozen places across Arkansas.
As African-Americans are working in timber industry, working on the railroads, working in coal mines in western Arkansas, more and more an expanding attempt to drive them out of all of these industries.
Towns where blacks were completely expelled and prevented from returning are referred to by academics today as sundown towns, stemming from posted warnings telling blacks not to stay after sunset. But Guy Lancaster is examining a larger phenomenon of racial cleansing in the South.
Racial cleansing can describe the expulsion of African Americans in areas that did not become sundown towns. In some places, expulsions did occur, but there remained a significant minority of African Americans in that area, like Walnut Ridge in 1912 was the site of a massive terrorism campaign against African Americans, but Walnut Ridge did not become a sundown town.
Walnut Ridge, a historic railroad town, lies northwest of Jonesboro in Lawrence County. Racial cleansings occurred with frequency, starting in the late 1880s at Amity in Clark County, on Crittenden County, and Forest City in St. Francis County. Lancaster points to tolerant Republican politics as one trigger.
And one of the cases I discuss was a Conway County case in 1885, where there was an attempt to drive away African Americans because they sort of represented the tipping point in Republican political authority there, that there were just enough, if whites could drive away a certain number, they could perhaps win at the ballot box.
Arkansas African Americans were attaining political power, Lancaster says, with 84 black legislators serving in the state general assembly between 1868 and 1893. That streak ended with the less tolerant Democratic Party taking control by 1874. Violent purges continued in Arkansas well into the 19th century. On the Ozark Highlands in 1906 in Harrison, at Cotter in Baxter County, and the expulsion of the Catcher community in Crawford County in 1923. But the most bloody in Arkansas may have been the 1919 Elaine Massacre on Phillips County, where a white mob attacked progressive black farmers who were meeting to obtain better prices for their cotton crops. As many as 200 blacks may have been killed, along with five whites.
You know, we retain the idea of sharecropping is largely the reserve of black laborers. But there was, even as degrading as a job could be, there was still immense competition for it.
During this era, just the perception of black-on-white crime could trigger a race riot. The Tulsa race war erupted after a white woman swore she'd been raped by a black man. Thousands of whites rampaged across a 35-city-block Greenwood district, referred to as the Black Wall Street of America. 10,000 blacks were left homeless, 1,200 homes destroyed. As many as 300 African Americans may have died. And the white woman, who claimed she'd been raped, recanted. Descendants have yet to be compensated. Guy Lancaster writes that perceived criminality pushed such violence.
It's what has been called racialized rightlessness. The fact that you know, race determines in America someone's criminal state.
Popular Jim Crow propaganda also spurred racial cleansings. Certain biologists of the day pointed to blacks as less evolved, cultivating widespread negrophobia. To illustrate, Guy Lancaster, in the final chapter of his book, discusses Salem in Fulton County in 1907.
Whites went to the Salem Cemetery, where African Americans are buried, dug up the black graves, and relocated them to an area called Pilot Knob. And there remains a tiny black cemetery there, only two headstones still standing.
A history which Guy Lancaster has recently discovered and continues to investigate. Even after the racial cleansings ended in Arkansas, Guy Lancaster writes that African Americans remain wary of certain places.
I actually had a recent conversation with my wife, Anna. She has a colleague who's African American. Both of them grew up in Hot Springs, and they were recently talking about sundown towns and racial cleansings. And my wife's colleague can remember growing up in Hot Springs and driving occasionally to St. Louis to visit family and the like, and being told, pack plenty of food, make sure your car is gassed up, especially when you're passing through these areas, because you don't want to stop there. I think it's fundamentally detrimental to our democracy that we have this disparity in how we conceive of these places in which we live.
Guy Lancaster's intention is to no longer relegate racial cleansings to African American history, but to integrate race violence into the white history record, bringing it further into the light. Racial Cleansing in Arkansas is published by Lexington Books, an imprint of Roman and Littlefield, New Studies in Southern History series. The work is being lauded as a new rigorous blueprint for understanding historic race violence in America. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can find copies of Racial Cleansing in Arkansas from Amazon, through your local bookseller, or by searching your public library. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. When the Cisneros Center, based in San Antonio, decided to launch the American Dream Initiative, it was looking for a community that had experienced significant growth in new immigration population and still did not have a fully developed infrastructure for immigrant integration. The center selected Northwest Arkansas as the community for the pilot year of the American Dream Initiative. Three fellows will be in Northwest Arkansas for 11 months to help guide a further integration of newcomers into the region. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked with three people closely connected to the program in Northwest Arkansas. Nick Padilla, the executive director of the Cisneros Center. Jessica Boyd, one of the three fellows working in Northwest Arkansas over the next 11 months. And Mike Malone, the president and CEO of the Northwest Arkansas Council. Kyle asked Nick, the executive director for the center, why Northwest Arkansas was picked for the pilot year of the center's first project.
So Northwest Arkansas is primed to take on this work. We have the ideal immigrant community. The immigrant community has grown tremendously over the last few decades. And we also have the leadership and the resources that are ready to get behind this work. So Northwest Arkansas is a very unique community in that this is exactly the right time to take this on.
Mike, what were the, I don't know if negotiation is the right word, but what were the conversations like approaching making the selection of Northwest Arkansas as the place for the pilot?
Well, at the core of what we do is partner with folks that are already engaged in this work. So we needed to know that people wanted us here. We needed to know that we could come into the community, build partners, and truly build on the infrastructure that exists. So we came in with sort of an open ear and an open mind to try to get as much information as we could.
The fellows will be here 11 months, is that correct?
They will be here 11 months.
And what will the fellows be doing during those 11 months?
So we're going to be working, like Mike and Nick have alluded to, on immigrant integration. And what that really means is we're going to be building relationships in the community, both with local organizations and also with the immigrant community and the receiving community here, to be sure that we are addressing all of the needs of the immigrant community and also the local organizations that are providing excellent services right now to bridge the gap and help immigrants fully integrate. So we're really committed to helping immigrants integrate linguistically, economically, civically into our society. And we really believe that it's going to be very beneficial for the Northwest Arkansas community as a whole to work on this immigrant integration initiative together.
So what are some of the ways that this will happen? That you can bring different cultured communities closer together more often?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we would really like to do is build partnerships with local organizations and really be a resource for them, help increase the visibility of these organizations to the immigrant community so that we can ensure the immigrant community is actually accessing the services that they need in order to integrate successfully. And then a large part of what we're doing will be focusing on the receiving community and ensuring that Northwest Arkansas is a welcoming community to immigrants. And I believe, like Nick said, this is the perfect community to do this because we already have these initiatives here and we already have the start of a welcoming community here in Northwest Arkansas.
Go ahead, Nick.
A major tool that we use in our approach towards immigrant integration is what we call the American Dream Roadmap. And the roadmap provides 10 steps, learning English, understanding the education system, becoming civically engaged, that put immigrant families on a path towards integration. What we do through this roadmap is both communicate to the immigrant community what the services should provide, right? What the steps are to be ready for the American dream, and also work with the community to support that journey towards the American dream.
Kyle, you know, more than half of our population has moved here from other states and many from other countries. And people move here for economic opportunities. They move here because of a great job. They move here for the quality of life that we're all enjoying. And so it just seems like a perfect time to try to focus our efforts and really maximize our resources to how we welcome everyone, how we engage the talent that's moving here. Whether they're immigrants from abroad, whether it's young professionals that move here mid-career, early in their career for a chance to work at a world-class company, or even graduates from school that want to stay. They moved here for school. Let's figure out how we can connect them in. So this is about engagement, engaging the talent that's moving here and really making us better connected. In my mind, it's a workforce retention opportunity as well.
It seems like there, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like there are some obvious potential partners that can help this getting started, where a lot of people go anyway. Churches, schools, work. Are those some of the basic places to start? And what are some of those that I'm not thinking of?
Absolutely. When we look at a community and begin to analyze how do we best move strategically, we like to think of it as an ecosystem. Right, where every single element of the community is interconnected. So like you said, churches, schools, work. But we also need to look at the corporate sector, the philanthropic sector, and the service providers. It's all interconnected, and we need to all come together to take on this issue as a community because no individual component will be able to do it by itself.
It tends to be human nature at times that the people who have lived in a place for a long time tend to be with the people they know, be that socioeconomic, be that I went to high school with this person or college and we've stayed. How do you get more assimilation, integration without forcing or making people of any, on either side, resent who might feel happy just being with the people they know right now?
Well, I think one of the strategies that we have seen work tremendously well is connecting those feelings and those ideas to people. Once people recognize that when you talk about a certain socioeconomic status or a certain ethnic group, you're actually talking about individuals and you are talking about faces. And once you make that connection, we have known, we've noticed that that tension tends to dissipate a little bit, at least a little bit. So that's a great first step, is to make the connection to, so that people realize that we're talking fundamentally about people.
And back to a point I mentioned earlier as well, people, regardless of their race or ethnicity or country of origin, they moved here for economic opportunities and they're great, or they moved here for the quality of life. And so it's a real shared set of priorities and goals. Great jobs, great recreational opportunities, great schools for the kids. If folks realize that these are all the kind of common threads that, that link us all, then we'll be off and running to build this community.
Well, what can you look for at the end of 11 months, at the end of this pilot project, that will tell you this has been successful?
Well, I'll tell you what. These 11 months are a first step. This process of integration is one that will take a long time, and one, like I said, that will take the entire community. I like to think of this as a mission that truly takes a village. At the end of 11 months, what we want to achieve is engaging the immigrant community, identifying effective service providers, and building a bridge between those two.
And I think for me as well, one of the most important things about this is that, like we've said, Northwest Arkansas is such a wonderful community to start this initiative in. This is the first community that the Cisneros Center is in trying to work on immigrant integration. And if we can be successful at what we're doing and build those bridges that Nick mentioned, this community can become a model for the nation on how immigrant integration should start in new gateway communities.
Nick, I know that you said this was a perfect place because there already seem to be these welcoming partners and things working well. How did you assess that?
I think it's pretty apparent when you meet with people, right? It didn't take long to realize that this place is truly unique, and that people here are friendly and welcoming. And I think the demographics speak for themselves. I mean, people wouldn't move here if there wasn't opportunity. People wouldn't move here if they didn't see a better future for themselves. And both within the immigrant community and within the receiving community, there is clear leadership to welcome this change and to see it, like Mike said, as an opportunity for the community to be more prosperous and to really set itself up for success.
This may be a question that's outside the purview of this conversation, and if it is, just tell me. But long range, do you know you've been successful if, when you look at school boards and city councils and state legislators, it's more representative of the population that lives in an area rather than a lot of people looking like me?
That is a very important part of integration, absolutely. I mean, that is not something that at this point we are pushing in any way or actively working towards, but that is a clear indication of integration when you have a diversity or a diverse group of leaders and a diverse representation in all cross sectors.
Because the reason I ask that is because you had mentioned becoming involved more civically to the immigration community, that get more involved with, I don't know, elections or...
Yeah, and civic engagement is it looks different depending on how you define it. But it's not just about election, but it's being involved in your community and realizing that yes, you may have come from a different country, and that heritage is incredibly important. But you are now a part of this community and a part of the United States, and that carries with itself certain responsibilities that we all must abide by. And that's an important shift that happens in immigrant communities.
So, Mike, from your perspective, over the next 11 months, what other partners would you like to see come in and roll up their sleeves and try to help?
We've already, through the Engage NWA partnership, been working with a number of nonprofits, several area businesses on related issues. And so we really like the approach of the Cisneros Center in that they wanted to come alongside good work and complement it. And so I think they'll be a natural fit with the partners that are already working in this space, and it'll just accelerate and enhance the efforts that are underway.
Someone's hearing this conversation and they would like to help out, be involved, but perhaps they're not a CEO, perhaps they're not a large employer or a school superintendent or teacher or whatever. What could they do? How can they reach out over the next 11 months?
So, like I said before, as fellows, we're really working on building relationships with everyone in the community. And we want to do that in so many different ways, whether that be co-hosting events with local organizations and getting the entire community involved in these activities, or working with individuals on their perspectives of the barriers that they're facing and the challenges in their day-to-day lives, or just talking to people about their experiences in Northwest Arkansas and how they view the community as a whole. I mean, we are willing to accept any help that anyone in the community is willing to give, because this is a community initiative.
And the easiest way to reach the Cisneros Center, you can just go on our website, and there's a clear way to send us a message, or you can just email us at contactus@cisnerocenter.org. And that is something that I personally will see and the fellows will see. So we are open to everyone and anyone.
Is there a role the press, media, communicators can play?
Absolutely. Like
your eyes got big.
We are here. No, but absolutely, because the media and the all of the communication gateways are critical in shaping the way that we view all of the sectors of society, and as such, we must work together to elevate the stories that need to be elevated and tell really the successes that the immigrant community has and the energy and vitality that the immigrant community has brought to the community, to Northwest Arkansas.
Can you tell us a success if this is going to sound perhaps really trite, but if I go to a rodeo or a baseball game and you see a mix in the crowd that represents the population that you have in this region?
Absolutely. I mean,
be as simple as that?
Absolutely. I mean, people, those networks and those connections are tremendously important when you're talking about integration. Because to your earlier point, if we're all living in separate parts of town and we're not actually interacting, what does that actually say about the integration status? So the interaction between groups is absolutely critical. I would say that this, we're talking about just Northwest Arkansas here, but this is something that's critical for the entire country. From now until 2050, 80% of our country's growth is going to be led by immigrants and their children, and that's 100 million people. And unless we step up and seize this opportunity to support the immigrant community, we're going to miss a tremendous opportunity and in many ways put our country at risk. So this is our opportunity to step up and do something that can be really beneficial for the country.
Yeah, and I would just add that I think immigrants are largely a part of the future of America.
And it always have been, right?
Always have been. That is our country. And if we can provide the resources and the opportunities that they need to achieve their full potential, the potential and the drive and the passion that they come here with, our nation is going to be a great nation.
Jessica Boyd is one of three fellows working in Northwest Arkansas for the pilot project of the American Dream Initiative, created by the Cisneros Center in San Antonio. We also heard from Nick Padilla, the executive director of the Cisneros Center, and Mike Malone, the president and CEO of the Northwest Arkansas Council. They talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio earlier this month. You can learn more at cisneroscenter.org. KUAF is supported by Clubhouse Fitness, located on Dixon Street in Fayetteville and offering training groups, cycling studios, ergonomic free weights, plus cardio and strength training equipment. Membership information and more available at clubhausfitness.com or by calling 287-HAUS. Razorback Run will be bringing back the tracks on Saturday, October 11th, beginning at 7:30 a.m. in Fayetteville. This 15K race and 5K run walk will benefit the Full Circle Food Pantry. Participants and volunteers are needed. Registration and more information available online at hogeyemarathon.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks for listening.